Good afternoon. I'm pleased to welcome you to the Economic Club of Indiana. I'm Deborah Daniels, a partner in the law firm of Krieg DeVault and president of the Economic Club. Thank you all for coming today. If I were to ask you today which nation is Indiana's leading trading partner, I'm guessing many of you would say it's either Japan or China, but you'd be wide of the mark by several thousand miles. Actually, our top trading partner lies to the north, Canada, and that has been the case for many years. And the Canadian lead isn't even close, since nearly 35% of all American exports, valued at nearly $12 billion annually, go north. In a distant second place is Mexico, with $3.9 billion, or a mere 10% of American exports. Nationally, the two-way exchange of goods and services amounts to $710 billion and supports more than 8 million jobs. So it's more than fitting that our special guest today should be the Canadian ambassador to the United States, the Honorable Gary Doer, a man who has held that post since October of 2009. Ambassador Doer is a public servant of long standing from Winnipeg, Manitoba, who previously served as the 20th Premier of Manitoba from 1999 to 2009, leading a new Democratic Party government. Ambassador Doer won three consecutive elections as Premier of Manitoba with increased majorities each time. In 2005, Business Week magazine named him one of the top international leaders on climate change. His government introduced balanced budgets each of his 10 years in office while reducing a number of taxes. In his role as ambassador, he works with a network of 15 trade missions and trade officers to manage the Canada-U.S. relationship, which includes a 55-year agreement to defend North America through NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense Command. He's encouraged U.S. approval of the Keystone XL oil sands pipeline. A leader with his record and responsibilities surely merits our attention. Ambassador Doer, we're delighted you can be here with us today.
Well, thank you very much, Deborah and friends. It's great to be here again in Indiana and Indianapolis. It's always an honor to be here. As the Canadian ambassador to the United States, though, I have to confess that the signs in the Lucas Oil Stadium required a great deal of simultaneous interpretation from the Canadian ambassador back to Canada after that football game a week ago here in this great city. There were signs all over the stadium indicating this was the Battle of 1812. And, you know, Canadians think we, A, won that war, and, B, they were just shocked at the intellectual curiosity of football fans all the way throughout the 90,000 people that were witnessing that great game a week ago Sunday. So I've had to explain Peyton Manning, number 18, Andrew Luck, number 12. That is the Battle of 1812. It wasn't the war that we often believe in Canada. So it's great to join you in that interpretation. I know you're pretty happy with the interpretive results of that game a week ago. It's great to be here with Roy Norton, our Consul General from this region. He has been here many, many, many times. He also was at that football game, that Battle of 1812. And he enjoys working with our sponsors and wants to thank them very much for hosting us here again today, and thank all of you for joining us. We, of course, have had the experience of working, I've had the experience of working with former Governor Daniels on energy and trade a few years ago here, and then Governor Pence just recently at the Great Lakes meeting where we talked about water quality, quantity, on the Great Lakes, coordinated strategies, and trade and energy as well. And so you have great leadership in this state, and it's great as a Canadian ambassador, and it's great for Roy Norton and I to work with all of you in these very, very important goals. Now, I mentioned that we've the War of 1812, but I would want to point out since that war, we have been allies, friends, and neighbors with the United States. And it's the most important part of my job as ambassador is to work with you as our allies on keeping our neighborhood secure and safe. And we work together on a daily basis, our two countries. Just last week, had a C-17 aircraft from Canada go to Arlington Air Force Base to pick up equipment to destroy chemical weapons, and part of the Assad capacity on chemical weapons with the agreement, the tentative agreement with Syria on chemical weapons. A couple of years ago, a Canadian general was the lead military figure on the war with Libya, with all NATO nations and two Arab League nations, a general that was trained in the United States, could parle français with our allies in Europe, and could utilize and work with the United States with its tremendous assets to have a regime change from the Gaddafi regime to hopefully one that over time can be more trusted and more democratic as we move forward. As we speak, we're together on Iran and wanting sanctions to work. Canada's part of those sanctions. And we want the negotiations to succeed. But Canada has the exact same view as the United States, that Iran obtaining a nuclear weapon is not an option. Containment is not an option for our neighborhood, for people in Europe, and that we will do everything possible to negotiate their capacity to build that bomb away, but containment is not the option if we fail to negotiate. And we're very clearly on the side of our American friends on that large and very, very complicated subject, but it's not complicated in terms of dealing with it after the fact. Finally, we're transitioning together in Afghanistan. We have been there since the beginning. We have recognized that the Taliban government sheltering and enabling the Taliban or the Al-Qaeda to attack the three places on September 11th was unacceptable, and to not take military action to defang that operation was unacceptable. And we have continued to work on a transition with the United States, a transition that is safer, we believe, for both our countries. Having said that, we take nothing for granted, and we are with you in a state of vigilance every day in that very, very challenging part of our world. So as I said, we have been allies together, and I think that's very, very important to note in terms of dealing with our relationship between Canada and the United States. It's not all about going from 84 to 85 pipelines, although I will talk about that later as a paid political announcement from Canada. But it is bigger than what we see on the news or what you may notice leading the news every day. As Deborah has pointed out, we have been together on a security perimeter relationship here in North America for 55 years. Was it 54 or 55?
Oh, I don't know.
Your facts are right. Whatever. But we have worked together since the Cold War and provided a perimeter security, air security, between Canada, with Canada and the United States. In fact, in the Olympics, just a few years ago in Vancouver, we would discuss our competitive nature. You being the United States, won the most medals in those Olympic Games, and we're happy to see that because it increased coverage of NBC back in Canada and around the world. And we were happy we were able to maintain our pride and honor by winning the women's and men's gold medal hockey medal. Having said that, and we don't think Putin should be able to take his shirt off if he isn't able to win the gold medal when they host the Olympics. A lot of people are clapping. They don't want him to take his shirt off ever again anyways, irrespective of that medal. But people don't know that both the maritime security and the air security was managed together between Canada and the United States at that border. And in fact, we've taken that experience and moved it to the Great Lakes and the St. Lawrence Seaway. this wonderful body of water, which is 20% of the fresh water in the world, also presents opportunity and risk. And we now have a new program called a Shipwrighter Program, where we have an RCMP officer and a Coast Guard officer from the United States on the same ship, so we can patrol that waterways together, sharing intelligence about who we should be worried about and ensuring that we can make trade and travel effective for citizens on both sides of the border. It also, in these tough budget times, saves a little bit of money. Why have two ships when one ship will do? I think it's a great budget idea, but we also think it makes a lot of sense for security. And so the President and the Prime Minister have announced beyond the border based on NORAD, and the whole idea is to manage risk before it gets to the border, to know who we're dealing with before we have a situation at the border, so we can actually be more efficient for cargo, more efficient for goods and services, more effective for travelers. In fact, we have 25 million Canadians that go to the United States, of a country of 34 million people every year, and we want that travel and trade to be based on common sense in managing risk. And so, therefore, trade is very, very important to us and very important to the President and the Prime Minister, and that's why we've announced this Beyond the Border program, modeled after NORAD, managing risk before it gets to the border. It is important that we have trade. As Deborah indicated, Canada is the largest customer of goods and services from the United States of any other country. And many people in Washington don't know that we buy more goods and services in Canada from the United States than the whole European Union put together. And so when you talk about Indianapolis and Indiana, we also, as Deborah pointed out, buy 35% of your exported goods is just a nine iron from Indiana to Canada, and we have that trade going into our country. So when people are trying to have trade missions to this country or that country, we say, just come on up to Canada. We're just a little ways away, and businesses, universities, elected representatives can, I think, increase their business by dealing with trade with Canada. This relationship is almost $2 billion a day. It isn't perfect. On the agricultural sector, which is about $330 million a day, we have a speed bump called country of origin legislation. We want to resolve that so we can maintain an integrated livestock and food processing industry, which we have over the last number of decades. We believe we can manage consumer rights to know your products and Canadian and American rights of an integrated agricultural sector by working together on this trade dispute. We do not want to build walls. We want to continue to build on-ramps for that integrated food processing and agricultural sector. And that's why Roy has been meeting with your farm representatives and your elected representatives to try to get a common sense kind of negotiated solution to that. In fact, when you look at trade, when we had a trade dispute on softwood lumber 10 years ago, the unintended consequence of that was Canada went from selling 4% of our wood to Asia to now selling 41% of our wood to Asia. So it makes more sense for us to manage these things instead of buy Canada, buy U.S., buy Indianapolis, buy Toronto. It's better to have a longer-term trade relationship. We just negotiated a tentative trade agreement with the European Union. That's good for Indianapolis because we now have access in your supply chain, which is very much north and south, into 500 million people in Europe. Now, that's going to take some time to authorize and get approval on both sides of the Atlantic. But we believe it's a good step forward. United States has talked about trade with Europe. This, I hope, helps that out. There's no such thing as a perfect trade agreement. We think it'll be good for the heartland here with the north-south trade, having predictable markets as part of your supply chains into Europe. We also have a trade agreement that we are trying to negotiate with you in Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now, If you went outside this room and said, what is TPP? I dare say the answer would be, I don't know. But Trans-Pacific Partnership is Canada, United States, and Mexico joining together with Asian countries, including Japan, to have a new trade agreement to have that would consist of two fundamental elements of trade. One is rule of law, and two is reciprocity. China is not part of those trade negotiations, but it's our view when we have rule of law and when we have reciprocity, people in Asia that are not part of the negotiations will be told to take the agreement we negotiate. And that's why it's very important we get it right. It's very important for business here in Indiana to have a say in that, and we are very committed to it as well. It will provide, as you know, it fits right in with your transportation agenda that was featured just recently with the governor creating a blue ribbon committee to look at the tremendous opportunities on transportation here in Indiana. I believe it's called Asia to Indiana Nonstop, and we very much believe that TPP and the intermodal work, partly with CN and other railways here and container businesses here, with the Blue Ribbon Committee the governor has established, presents a tremendous opportunity for all of you for both two-way trade to Asia, hopefully in a more predictable way when we get a TPP trade agreement with the countries that are now negotiating it. We believe that that will be very, very important. I'm just raising a red flag to you, those of you who are in processing or manufacturing or value added on the transportation trade routes, to be very, very careful. There's a port proposal in the Senate to have a tax on ports or a tax potentially added to ports in Canada for containers that come from Canada to the United States. This is the third attempt. I feel like I'm, as ambassador, I'm playing whack-a-mole. Every time there's a proposal, I got to find a way to hit it down back into the, where it should be, and that's nowhere. But we do not want to tax your goods. We don't want you to tax our goods. We don't want this nonstop Asia route that's 6 days closer to be dictated by somebody else that, for political reasons, doesn't feel their own port is strong enough to compete. We would like to have the Manning luck kind of competition and no tilt on it. And we very much want you to advise your delegation, Democrat and Republican, this is not good for Indiana, certainly not good for Canada, and it's not good for this vision that the governor is articulating here in this state. I want to thank you for another transportation route called the Detroit-Windsor Bridge and your support for that. It's taken 12 years. We've got an agreement now. We have the nine agencies in the United States all approving a presidential permit to have that bridge. It also speaks to some of the challenges you have. As ambassador and Roy as consul general, almost one-third of the goods, 130,000 cars a year from Indiana, go across the existing bridge, which really puts us in a tremendously vulnerable situation to put all our cars in one basket, all our transportation in one basket, north and south. So we think a second bridge makes a lot of sense. Having said that, there was a problem of financing that bridge, so Canada decided to finance the bridge. Thankfully, we had resolutions from your state capital and other places along the Midwest. But when we got the financing in place, unfortunately, we came engaged in an old Buy American law that would not allow us to have this bridge that we're financing between our two countries to go out to tender to companies on both sides of the border. I had to explain to our Prime Minister and to the U.S. administration that it's not a diving board, it's a bridge. It touches the other side of the border. And therefore, Buy America doesn't make sense. And a lot of times when we bring protectionist behavior in place, or you do, it doesn't, at the end of the day, make sense. Softwood lumber, Buy America on the bridge. We finally got a waiver. What a novel idea. Buy Canada and U.S. for a bridge that goes between our two countries. It took us about 4 months to get it, but at least we got that approval. And the only thing now missing is a customs plaza. So we have a bridge to the United States with no custom plaza. Okay, we've got the customs plaza approved in Canada. You can use ours, or you can build yours. But let's just get it done. We take a common sense approach to these things. Let's just get it done and get that bridge across our two countries. Finally, I want to talk about energy. Last week, it was the people were commiserating or commemorating or celebrating or commenting on the 40th anniversary of OPEC. And it didn't get a lot of coverage in Washington because the media was focused in on other issues of the day, so to speak. He says diplomatically to his American audience. They were focused in on one other issue that seemed to consume all the media, all the networks, all cable television, nonstop. But it is interesting to note that many, many CEOs in the United States went on to state that Canada and United States and Mexico have it within our grasp to have energy independence in North America by developing our resources together as three countries in this neighborhood. We've talked about it. We've thought about it. We've preached about it. We've hinted at it. And now we have the opportunity to move forward. And it has a number of elements to it. Certainly, energy efficiency should be number one, the number one objective for energy independence. The less you use, the better you are in terms of dependence. And Canada and the United States, one of the great examples of that, in the middle of the auto crisis, we went and had the same standard on light vehicle emission standards to reduce emissions from cars by 50% by the year 2025. It's actually had the added benefit of people buying more of those cars. So it's had cleaner air, cleaner water, and more cars being sold. So number one is energy efficiency. Energy renewables is number two. Canada has 64% of its electricity generated from renewable energy. We believe, obviously, you're looking at that. Deborah was mentioning how many windmills are on Highway 66 to Chicago. What's that?
65.
I knew I'd get one of those numbers wrong, so I apologize. But get more windmills. You know, we believe it's part of the overall approach. It's not either or, it's part. We think the development of gas is a tremendous step forward for our neighborhood again. It provides reliable, affordable energy for the United States, and we believe it will continue to result in more insourcing of jobs, more investments in the manufacturing sector in the United States. It's actually ironic because there's a pipeline that we approved from Pennsylvania to Canada to displace gas from Alberta to Ontario. That's actually the way the Canada-U.S. trade agreement is supposed to work, and we approved that pipeline. No problems, no difficulties, no protests, just made common sense. And now we have oil. And it's in the United States, it's in Canada, it's in potentially in Mexico, if they amend their constitution, dealing with Pemex. And we have the ability to have oil in our three countries to have energy independence, we believe, from countries that are not our friends. The petrodictators that have been determining the policies on oil and cost of oil for the last 40 years. So for us, Keystone Pipeline is part of that. You should know, as ambassador, that Texas is the largest consumer of Crown Royal on a per capita basis than any other state in the United States. I mention that because I know Hillary Clinton was drinking Crown Royal when she was at the bowling alley during the primaries. But it's easier to get Crown Royal in a pipeline to Texas than it is oil right now. I can't understand it. So we know there's a role for trucks in oil industry. We know there's a role for trains. But we also know there's a role for pipelines, which have 8% less greenhouse gases than rail. And no disrespect to all my friends in the rail industry. They will continue to be part of energy security in this neighborhood. The capacity is dramatically improved, but we just think it makes sense to build this pipeline. Daniel Yergin, a noted energy expert, said last month that if the pipeline is not approved, it would make no difference on greenhouse gases. In fact, it would be higher greenhouse gases without the pipeline being approved. And the biggest winner would be Venezuela. And the second biggest winner would be the Middle East. So our message is very clear here today. You could choose Canada over Venezuela. You can choose blue-collar workers over hedge fund managers. You can choose Middle America, because Bakken oil from North Dakota and Montana is also part of this pipeline, Middle America over the Middle East, and we can go ahead choosing energy security and energy independence in North America by approving this pipeline. We should continue to work together on trade, transportation as allies, and part of being allies is keeping our neighborhood secure, and part of security is energy security. My paid political announcement today is go with Canada and go with that pipeline. Thank you very, very much. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. And as a reminder to all of you, please use the white cards on your table if you have a question for Ambassador Duer, or you may tweet us at Economic Club IN. So we'll start with perhaps this. You made a subtle reference to it, but what is your reaction to the apparent gridlock currently occurring in the United States?
Oh, this is a good interesting diplomatic question.
I'm just testing you.
Just testing you, okay. Well, first of all, United States is a can-do country. And most people in the world, including Canada, believe that United States, the economy is starting to grow, housing starts are beginning to rise, house values are starting to be returned to their levels of 4 or 5 years ago, energy is being developed, there's more patents per capita than any other country in the world. Innovations every day we see and buy from the United States. So there's a separation between the can't-do from time to time situation in Washington and the can-do situation in the United States. So I just want to separate that what's going on in gridlock with what's going on in the whole economy, including in this room. We believe we're concerned about the defaulting on the debt. All countries are. But I would point out United States has gone from 9% deficit as a percentage of GDP down to 4%, or just over 4. Canada has gone down to about 1.25%, maybe 1% with the latest numbers. We plan on balancing the budget by 2015. So as trading partners, we're heading. Thank you. Thank you very much. We plan on doing that. I'll come back if we do. I think we will. And it's easier said than done, but we're just tracking down every year, every budget. So we believe that reducing deficits without killing the economy is important. And we wish you well. We'd like an earlier agreement, please. This is my fourth crisis. I haven't been here for, I've just been here 4 years, and people know that United States is a can-do country. They just want some of these fiscal situations to be resolved in a can-do and timely way. That's my other non-paid political announcement to you.
And a similar question came up as you were speaking. What lessons might the U.S. learn from Canada as we struggle to reinvigorate our economy?
Well, I think that for all of us, it's just trying to make decisive and quick decisions on the obvious as quickly as possible. I mentioned energy. In a lot of ways, I think all of us have won the lottery and just don't know how to cash the ticket. So I think that we should be more decisive. It's not dissimilar, by the way. Oil and gas gets discussed, but building a transmission line for wind from Montana to Lethbridge gets stopped because it has to go, you know, I remember Arnold Schwarzenegger told me the story that he was going to replace a plant in San Diego with solar from the desert, and everybody cheered, and then the next day they opposed the transmission line to get it there. So I think And it's for Canada, it's the same thing. Sometimes it's one lawyer per megawatt to build a transmission line. So I just think we've got to be more decisive. You know, when the people that are unemployed want fast, intelligent, due diligent decisions and get on with it instead of this battle of one-trick ponies that goes on in all countries, especially in democracies. It's messy, but we've got to move on.
Thanks. What is the current status and future outlook for the Canadian nuclear energy program? And will Canada consider adoption of new reactor technology like the Westinghouse AP1000?
Which is a small... first of all, I want to thank Westinghouse for their investments. We believe we have all energy sources as part of our electrical grid, and we know that the United States has many of the same sources as we do. We let the market decide. I think there's two challenges for nuclear. Three on the environmental side is the issue of waste, and I know the Westinghouse new machine has dealt with a lot of those issues right up front with the new equipment. The second issue is capital costs. It's high, and if you're a politician or a utility, you have to put it on your books for a long period of time. So what you do today, if you're a governor or premier and you're backing up some of the capital costs, you end up showing it on your books and then handing the next person, the next governor, a balanced budget while you've taken on all this liability. So and the media doesn't differentiate between capital and operating, and either sometimes do the markets do a lot more. And I think the third issue is the cost relative to gas. And I think that these decisions will be made in the market, and we respect that.
Someone has asked, will dairy be part of the TPP agreement? Dairy be part of TPP?
Yes, we all drink milk. All TPP countries drink milk. Yes, they will be part of it.
That was easy.
How it will happen, I'm not sure, and what will be in it, I'm not going to give you any guarantee, but we like milk in Canada.
Here's an easy one for you. Comment on the Canadian healthcare system and healthcare reform in the U.S. In 30 seconds or less.
Well, we've taken a bit of time to get our healthcare system to where it is today. It would be totally inappropriate for a U.S. ambassador to Canada to tell us what to do with healthcare, and I am going to use that as my segue into saying that one of the issues that both of us are going to have to continue to manage is the imploding demographics with exploding costs. And so our system now is 11.6% of GDP. Yours is tracking up to 18% of GDP. So whatever happens under whatever system, that is something all of you have to pay attention to, as we do in Canada, try to flatten out some of those costs. Did I dodge that well
enough?
Boy,
you did a fine job.
Okay, good.
You must be a diplomat.
All right, well, we used to have question period in Canada. It wasn't answer period, but it was question period in a parliamentary system.
You've been, as we indicated in your introduction, mentioned as a top leader on the subject of climate change. It seems that most people now accept that some climate change is occurring, and many think that humans are to blame, but there seems to be disagreement about the extent of the change, the impact of the change, and the impact on of the remedies that seem to be very expensive with perhaps little impact. How would you react to that?
Well, I think Canada and the United States, and this is an interesting historical story. I've heard it from George Shultz, who I really admire. He's worked with people for a long time and knows a lot. And he said when they were looking at the Canada-U.S. being part of the ozone-depleting material agreement, which became the Montreal Protocol, they looked at people said it won't harm anybody, it will harm somebody, we don't have to take action, we should take action. I think President Reagan said at that time in the meeting with George Shultz that we don't really know, and it's better to have insurance by taking action. And we actually signed the Montreal Protocol agreement together, which, by the way, has actually reduced GHGs more than Kyoto, and to deal with ozone-depleting material. So my view is that we should take action where we can, and we should buy insurance when we have the opportunity. But at the same time, we can do it in a way that creates jobs. I was involved in it, and energy efficiency and a lot of energy development will create jobs, not cost jobs. We've got to be very careful about it. You can't go into too many boutique-y things in a fragile economy because you end up not being able to afford it. As a premier, we had to send out utility bills. So if we got too high on the cost per kilowatt hour of something, it was pretty fundamental. You were defeated. That dog would not hunt. So you had to be very careful. I think we should have that in policy making all around United States and Canada. But I think ozone depleting material in hindsight has been an interesting example. So I'll quote the Gipper.
Thank you. And your answer is a good segue to this next question. What is the projected number of jobs that will result from the Keystone project, and what other economic impact of the project is there to Canada and the U.S.? And there was a similar question. How does your estimate differ from President Obama's, and where do you get your figures?
Well, my estimate differs greatly from the president because he can approve the pipeline or flick it away like a foreign object on a salad. So that's the first difference. We go with the State Department report, and it says 40,000 direct jobs during the construction stage, and indirect jobs, companies like Cummins here in Indiana. You've seen the refinery was 2,000 jobs just south of Chicago in Indianapolis, or Indiana, and I've been to that plant. I think the supply chain in Canada and the United States, with oil being developed here, 85 cents on the dollar goes back to our economy. I think the numbers in the State Department report indicate less than 30 cents on the dollar to the Middle East. So we think the direct jobs are there. I was at a meeting with the White House with jobs, and Caterpillar was there, and Michelin tires were there, and 40% of their sales were to Canada. And you know that in Indiana. So I just believe that there's not as many jobs after the construction is completed as there is during it. But I think anytime you use the term more jobs and you get into an argument of how much more, everybody says more jobs is good. Same amount of jobs is not good. I say go with more jobs. That's the Keystone Pipeline.
Thank you. We got this question. You were talking about, of course, the great benefit of trade between our countries, and someone wrote, one of our big concerns is counterfeit medicines coming through Canada from fake Canadian pharmacies. What is Canada doing to prevent this?
Well, I think we had some challenges with crystal meth, as you did, and I experienced as premier. And we worked together. The governors and premiers worked together. The two national governments worked together. We've passed new laws prohibiting the sale of bulk materials from stores, retail stores. It is clearly meant to manufacture products like crystal meth. There are other products. In fact, there was an article again today about other materials that can be used to make illegal drugs from other sources. And whether it's drugs that are used as sources or just items you can buy in a retail store, we very much support a coordinated north-south strategy on doing everything we can to prohibit and prevent those materials from coming in the hands of people that would come into harm by consuming them.
And in a similar vein, and you touched on this, I think, in your remarks, but how are Canada and the United States cooperating these days to address security threats and discourage potential terrorists from attempts to cross each other's borders?
As I said, the beyond the border is that the whole idea is that we will manage risk, whether it's cybersecurity, international terrorists, domestic terrorists, before they get to either one of our borders. And every day I know that with the proper, not gratuitous, but sharing of information, we're safer. Just recently, there are three alleged terrorists that were going across the border and blow up a train, allegedly, going to New York, two Canadian citizens, allegedly, and one American citizen in the FBI. And I want to thank the FBI for their great cooperation, work with the RCMP to make those arrests on both sides of the border. We don't have a lot of examples like that because it isn't as obviously international because the arrests are made in either country and convictions are made in either country. But we keep track of each other's people that are present risk for each other. And we'll be able to do more of that when we have a customs plaza at the Detroit-Windsor Bridge.
Did you say a customs plaza? Is that correct?
Yeah,
think we should have a...
Okay. Yeah. We don't want another diving board. We want a customs plaza.
We got three questions along the same line. What is your perspective on recent revelations about the NSA? One of them said, is there a positive side for U.S.-Canada relations? And another one said, is the NSA listening to your cell phone?
Well, somebody might be, I hope. My family. I think that Canada, United States, is part of a Five Eyes organization where we share intelligence with each other and do not allegedly spy on each other, he says. And so that includes Canada, United States, the U.K., New Zealand, and Australia. And that's the agreement that some of the European countries have asked for, I think it was an article today, have asked for that agreement. And it's resulted in some really important discoveries. It was a Canadian cybersecurity team that found cyber attacks on some U.S. major infrastructure that was shared immediately with the U.S. I mentioned the FBI and RCMP. So I'm not sure what will eventually come out of the revelations that come out every day, but we have a good professional working relationship with the intelligence and police law enforcement agencies in Canada and the United States. And we're part of a Five Eyes organization, we call it.
And to give you an idea of how much interest there is in that topic, I got a fourth question as I was asking the question.
Yes. It's topical.
Quite.
If you're in Washington and walking down the street and phoning to find out how your football team did, you have to assume that somebody's listening to that call. And I don't mean Americans listening to it. Somebody is listening to that call. There's 100,000 people in one country, which I will not name, but it's a big country, that has 100,000 people on the payroll whose job it is to know what you're doing. So.
Well, thank you for that encouraging response.
Okay, well, I've never said anything I regret. Have you?
No.
Okay, there you go.
Let's try this
okay.
more friendly question. Could you comment on the success of Canada's early childhood education program and how it promotes long-term economic development? And I know this came to us from someone who's working very hard on that subject here.
I think for those of us who have been in public office, we believe that the research is pretty solid that one-year investment in early childhood development will result in 7 years, seven times economic opportunity for those that are able to receive it. And so for a little amount of money, you could provide programs, and they vary from different province to different province and different community groups from and religious groups to different community groups and religious groups across Canada. But it's generally felt that investing in early childhood development helps when children get to school, they're able to succeed at a much higher rate of success in early years in school, which are so critical, and all the way through their school period have a more significant and higher literary rate and graduation rate from high school. And it sometimes shows up in these standard exams, although we don't have enough research to look at that, the standard exams that you see sometimes for all the OECD countries. So investing in education as early as possible, is whether it's a parent or a program, is always very, very valuable. Parents that read with kids at home, can't beat it.
Thank you. We like to end with a question that has great significance to many people, so here it is. I understand there's a clause buried in the U.S. immigration bill that would allow Canadian snowbirds to spend 8 months per year in the U.S. instead of the current 6 months. I have very good retired Canadian friends that would like to spend an extra 2 months. Is there any hope? And then we have sort of a related question. How many Canucks are in the audience? So you may want to ask.
I may want to ask. I don't know whether that's breaching any privacy rules right now. On immigration, Canada's immigration on a macro level is two-thirds skilled, one-third family. United States right now, looking at changing their immigration system, is two-thirds family, one-third skill. So that is the macro framework difference. We had a weakness in our refugee system that took too long to decide, which represented a problem in human terms. Kids would grow up and not know whether they're going to stay here. And on the security terms, the longer people are here without documentation or without authorization represents a risk. And so we changed the refugee laws just recently with an all-party agreement to do it. You could argue it made sense on both sides of the debate. On the immigration bill, it has been proposed by members of Florida and Arizona. I'm not sure whether any senators from Indiana have proposed it. To go from 6 months to 8 months, subject to the fact that you can't work and make a salary there, but you can only spend money and drink beer in warm weather before you go back like a snowbird up north. And it is embedded in one of the Senate bill. We would like to see a little bit of that money from the Senate immigration bill move from the southern border to that border plaza on the Detroit-Windsor border, just a little bit, just the crumbs off the table in that appropriation bill. And then, we wish you well with the bill. And it does, you know, there's different health care coverages in Canada. Some provinces have a six-month requirement to maintain your health programs in Canada. I don't know how all those will work together. But there are some people that are looking at that. And as I say, Canadians love to travel. 24 million visits a year to the U.S. with a country of 35 million people. So let people know the secrets of Indianapolis and Indiana, because if there's something we should look at and discover, we'll be right on down to discover it here in Indianapolis.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Ambassador, for taking the time to speak with us today. Today's presentation will be broadcast on WFYI Public Radio 90.1 FM on Monday, November 4th at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and is also available for download at WFYI.org. Please join us next month on Tuesday, November 12th, to hear from Beth Brook, Global Vice Chair of Public Policy with Ernst & Young. Beth will return to Indianapolis to share her wide breadth of experience in both the public and private sectors. Be sure to purchase your tickets today to hear one of the world's 100 most powerful women, according to Forbes magazine. Information and tickets for each of this season's presenters can be found at economicclubofindiana.com. Thank you, and have a wonderful afternoon.